This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
WNYC Studios is supported by W.W. Norton & Company, publishers of The Road to Freedom, Economics and the Good Society, by Nobel Prize-winning economist Joseph E. Stiglitz. The Road to Freedom, essential reading for those committed to the American ideal of an economic and political system that delivers well-being, opportunity, and meaningful freedoms for all. The Road to Freedom, available now wherever books are sold.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of WNYC Studios and the New Yorker.
Welcome to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. For years now, there's been a concern that computerized voting machines are somehow less secure than the old paper ballots we used. What would happen if someone with ulterior motives got access to the software that counts the votes? What kind of mischief could they do? In May 2021, it happened. And it happened through the person who was in charge of securing the votes, an election clerk in the state of Colorado.
In Mesa County, Colorado, the election clerk, a woman named Tina Peters, somehow got into her head months after the election of Joe Biden that the election had been stolen and that thousands of dead people had voted in the election that she was in charge of running.
Staff writer Sue Halpern has been reporting for us on election security, including the Tina Peters case.
And so she allowed Stop the Steal activists to come into her office and copy the Dominion voting system software that was running the tabulators that they used to count the votes in Mesa County. Then they posted that information on the internet. So essentially they released it into the wild for anyone to take a look at and potentially try to figure out if there were any vulnerabilities. If a hacker would like to get into these systems, they now basically have the key to the castle.
Dominion is one of the big voting machine companies. You, of course, remember that they were the target of far-out conspiracy theories involving George Soros and Hugo Chavez of Venezuela, all pushed by Trump's lawyer, Sidney Powell, among others. And the theft of the software in Colorado was not an isolated incident.
Unfortunately, this has happened in a number of other jurisdictions around the country, often in swing states, not surprisingly. And the breach that I think is getting the most attention right now is one that actually happened in January, on January 7th, 2021. And it was at the behest of Sidney Powell, one of Trump's lawyers, who hired some computer forensic experts, i.e. hackers, to go into the election office in Coffee County, Georgia, and they managed to copy every single bit of election software and data that existed.
Newly obtained video to CNN shows a former Georgia Republican county official escorting two operatives hired by an attorney for former President Trump into the county's election offices on the same day a voting system there was illegally breached.
One of the few people to legally obtain access to the Dominion voting machines is a computer scientist named J. Alex Halderman. Halderman consulted in a court case involving Dominion in 2018. And he found that the machines could, in fact, be hacked. His report was put under seal, and the federal agency in charge of cybersecurity sent an advisory to districts that use those machines. So he knows more about how computerized voting works than almost anyone.
honestly, it keeps me up at night knowing that some of that software is out there after what I found in my time analyzing it and what I know other people could find in short order.
J. Alex Holderman spoke with Sue Halpern.
Your research has been kind of co-opted by the Stop the Steal folks. Like they look at your research and they say, you know, these machines are hackable. We shouldn't trust them. You know, Alex Holderman, a professor of computer scientists, the world's leading expert on Dominion voting systems, he said so. What's that like for you? I mean, that is clearly not how you intended your work to be used.
Oh, my God. It's the worst feeling in the world when people co-opt my work to lie to people. And that's largely what's been going on when it's been held up as this is the proof that the 2020 election was somehow fraudulent. As a scientist, it's my job to try to explain the way the world really works as best as we can understand it with scientific methods. And I can't not do that just because they're going to inconveniently agree with certain false theories.
Yeah, that's hard, though.
It's extremely hard, but it's a reason and a reminder of why I think everyone who works around elections needs to be especially clear in their claims and in their communication. And we've seen claims that omit very important nuance coming from all sides, both from people who are trying to convince the public that the 2020 election was fraudulent, of course, and from people who are trying to reassure the public. So the strongest kind of claim I think that experts who are being careful can make right now is that there's no sound evidence that there was any kind of fraud in the 2020 election. I wish we could make the claim that our elections are well secured, but I don't think we can get there just yet. Like, we have a long way to go to make sure that elections provide the kind of security the public deserves.
Does the work that you did in Georgia on these Dominion machines, does the fact that now those same systems are out and about in the wild because of the Coffee County breach, does that change how we should be thinking in general about election security? I mean, it just seems like, you know, you did your work. It was scary enough that the court decided the public couldn't see it. But that came before we knew that this software was out there.
As we've seen from the examples in Coffee County and Mesa and elsewhere, bad actors potentially can get access to the machines, both to the software because it's been leaked and potentially to the operating environment where the machines are being housed and used. And then after those vulnerabilities are discovered, attack software is coded. It's just a matter of brief access to slip something malicious into the system. So what we need to do, what we need is just a sea change in the way we think about trust in election systems. It's not sustainable to say that the public can only trust election systems if they trust the Dominion Company and they trust their local election officials. Just, we're never all going to agree. And it's never going to be enough to make sure that those systems are actually well secured. So what we need is to reverse the burden of proof almost. Election systems should be designed so that they generate affirmative evidence that the outcome is right. It shouldn't be us scratching our heads and asking, is there any evidence that the system has been corrupted? Because that's usually an impossible burden of proof to meet, even if there was an actual well-designed attack.
The design of these systems is essentially a black box. You're one of the few people to legitimately gain access, take them apart, and analyze how they work.
From the very beginning, this has been a topic where companies have been secretive, have not wanted outside scrutiny of the way their technology works. And that's perhaps for competitive reasons, but I think more so it's because publicity about things that don't work is not good for their business. Many years ago, back when I was a graduate student at Princeton, my research group was actually the first group of scientists in the country to get our hands on a real U.S. voting machine and be able to take it apart and figure out how it worked. As the senior-most student, I was the one in charge of going and picking up the machine, which we got from an anonymous source who our lawyers assured us had acquired it legally, but who wanted to keep the origin secret. I double parked in front of this hotel near Times Square, and then I went into the alleyway in the back of the hotel, and I swear, a man in a trench coat met me with a black leather suitcase that had the voting machine in it. And a lot of the secrecy at the time was because we were all dreadfully afraid that the company that made the machine would sue us, try to stop us from publishing science about it. But they didn't ultimately, and we made a number of discoveries, including that the machine had vulnerabilities that basically anyone could exploit to inject malicious software and change votes. Now, subsequent to that work, two states, California and Ohio, brought in teams of scientists to do similar studies on all of their election equipment. And California decided that they would have a paper trail for every vote going forward. But not all states got the news. And one of the most revealing data points to me is that Georgia, up until January of 2020, used those same Diebold paperless voting machines that I studied back in grad school. And they never patched the software. They still had exactly the same vulnerabilities that we had discovered and published now 16 years ago, until the day they were thrown away.
But when they were thrown away, they then replaced them with these Dominion systems. So one of the things kind of interesting about this whole subject is watching how partisan right-wing activists have begun calling for, you know, the end of computerized voting machines. They're talking about how we need hand-marked paper ballots, and then they want those hand-marked paper ballots to be counted by hand. They want to get rid of the scanners and the tabulators. Is that the right way to secure American elections?
Well, no. Unfortunately, these solutions that they're proposing, they're not entirely fact-driven either. The biggest limitation is that, well, we just can't count ballots by hand practically in the American system at scale. There are a lot of countries that do count by hand, even in Canada and in a lot of Europe, but generally they have much simpler ballots than typical American jurisdictions, where we might have, you know, 30 or 40 questions on the ballot. The amount of time it takes to count the ballots goes up with each additional race. So if we want results in a timely way, we want them to be counted accurately, and we want to continue to vote on so many issues, we inevitably are going to have to enlist technology to help. But we don't have to just blindly trust that technology. And I think this is what the Stop the Steal movement misses, that we can make use of technology in elections without just having to have faith that it's operating correctly and the people who are operating it are doing everything right. And the most important part of that is auditing the results of the election in a statistically rigorous way, what's known as a risk-limiting audit. But what a risk-limiting audit does is it has people go and look at the original, hopefully hand-marked paper ballots, and you look at enough of them to rule out with high probability the possibility that the computer outcome is wrong. In an election that's a landslide, you only have to look at a few ballots to do that. If the election's a tie, well, you'd want to go and recount them all by hand the same way we might traditionally do a recount of a very, very close race. But a risk-limiting audit lets you use technology to count quickly without having to blindly trust that technology to get the right answer.
How worried are you right now about the security of the midterms and then going forward to 2024?
One thing that's keeping me up at night is I worry that something is going to visibly go wrong, even if it's not as a result of an attack, and it's going to be hit on to undermine the legitimacy of the entire electoral process. That's kind of what happened in 2020. We had one jurisdiction in Michigan that really did announce the wrong presidential results on election night, Antrim County. And that experience, even though it was just the result of human error, reverberates to this day in conspiracy theories. But attacks that try to convince people falsely that election results were wrong are just as much an attack as an attack that changes the numbers to get the wrong election result. Too many different things to worry about, unfortunately. But let me try to be a bit more optimistic for a moment, because I'm not 100% pessimistic about election security. I think maybe the only reason I'm still doing it after all of these years is that I'm an infinite optimist about it. Because I think it really is a problem space where we can solve things. Compared to other cybersecurity problems, compared to securing the energy grid or the medical system or the financial system, like, elections are a small space, a relatively easy constellation of actors to change the practices of. It's a problem we can tackle, and it could be, especially if we get congressional action, a great success story for this country in terms of securing a major area of critical infrastructure. And optimistically, I'd like to think that that can happen. And I think what's going to happen first, though, is that we're going to have to get enough distance between ourselves and the 2020 election that people stop thinking in terms of whether something is an election-denying conspiracy theory, and instead people think about, well, we're all citizens of this country, and everybody deserves the ability to trust the results of our elections.
J. Alex Halderman is a professor of computer science and engineering at the University of Michigan. He spoke with staff writer Sue Halpern. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour with more to come.
Climate change affects everyone, but it doesn't affect everyone equally. Immigrants often bear a unique burden due to climate change, but they're also leading the way with impactful solutions. Feet in Two Worlds, the news outlet and journalism training organization for immigrant voices, presents Home Interrupted. From flooded basement apartments in New York City to indigenous Maya farming practices in Nebraska, Feet in Two Worlds, Home Interrupted brings you deeply reported original stories from across the United States. Episodes drop each week starting April 2nd. Find Feet in Two Worlds, Home Interrupted wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. And this is Vincent Cunningham, one of our theater critics, on stage at the New Yorker Festival with the playwright Susan Laurie Parks.
It feels very stilted to read an introduction for you, because I always tell people the first Broadway show I saw was Cats as a middle schooler. And the second one was Top Dog Underdog. It's one of the reasons I studied literature, cared about the theater. You like sort of are the reason I'm even here talking to you. So I just am so happy to be here with you.
As Vincent said, Parks' influence has been enormous over the years.
She's still probably best known, though, for Top Dog Underdog, a two-man show about a pair of brothers named Lincoln and Booth. They're struggling with poverty, with the weight of American history, and their own bitter rivalry. Top Dog Underdog opened on Broadway in 2002, and 20 years later, it's just been revived in a production with Corey Hawkins and Yahya Abdul-Mateen II. Here's Vincent Cunningham talking with Susan Laurie Parks.
Susan Laurie Parks is the first African-American woman to receive the Pulitzer Prize in drama. Other of her awards include the MacArthur Genius Grant, the Dorothy and Lillian Gish Prize. Her theater credits include Top Dog Underdog, The Book of Grace, Unchain My Heart, the Ray Charles musical, and the upcoming plays for the Plague Year, which we'll talk about. She wrote the screenplays for The United States versus Billie Holiday and Girl Six, wrote the novel Getting Mother's Body, which I'm sorry, I will pay back one day. I read the whole thing in a Barnes & Noble when I was in college. I'll Venmo you for that experience. and she was the creator, head writer, and executive producer for the series Genius. Additionally, Susan Laurie Parks fronts the band Sula and the Noise. Thank you so much for being with us. It's such an honor.
Happy to be here. Thank you.
We should start with Top Dog Underdog because it's being revived on Broadway. You kind of shocked the theater world and the rest of the world when it came out. It felt like an avalanche. Now you, of course, are working with a different pair of wonderful performers. How do you even think about it living in other bodies?
Well, yeah, that's a great question. I mean, as a playwright or as a writer of dramatic literature, you know, that's something that we grow accustomed to, you know. I write my specifically plays. I mean, films are, you know, that's just for the one actor and they do the performance. But with plays, you have to write it so that it endures. You know what I'm saying? It has to be passed around from hand to hand, from community to community, from continent to continent, through the ages, long, hopefully, after you pass away. And the script will endure and be something that artists can come to and embody. And it's built like that. It's built with that in mind, if it's written well. So I believe that Top Dog is written very well, and it has been done by many, many, many people, and not only men of African descent. All kinds of different folks have felt like, hey, I have a place in here. Might I do it also? And I'm like, sure, it's your production. Go for it. You know what I mean? And so I just sit back, and Kenny Leon is such a brilliant director, and I just sit back and go, yeah, that looks good. Like that. It's very, no, though I did change the one thing they were talking about. You give someone your number and you tell them that you have a home. Because in 1999, when I wrote it, landlines were the thing, right? And now I've changed it. It's the same rhythm. So you give someone your number, telling them one thing, that you have a home. You give someone your number, telling them one thing, that you have a phone. Hello. Right, so it's the same rhythm, different words, because now giving someone your phone number tells them that you have a phone, not necessarily a home. So little changes like that, but it wasn't specific to the guys. You know,
right.
It was just the world that we live in now.
Wow. Do you think metrically like that when you write?
Totally, totally. So they say, Scripture says, and I am a fan of Scripture, in the beginning was the Word, mm-hmm. right? But that might just be the Word's point of view. I mean, all respect intended. But that might just be the Word's point of view. Because I had a notion last night. In the beginning was the groove. And that, I was like, yeah. Because the groove, I think, comes before the Word. See, so this is me up late at night thinking. You know, or feeling thing and surmising, yeah. Perhaps. Because I do write to the groove. I write to the groove. Just to the groove. And I can tap it out. It's all lyrics to me.
Mm-hmm. I've heard you say that your dad, when you were young, you moved around a lot.
Yeah, he was in the service. He was in the army. He was in service. Yeah.
I've heard you say that he bought, when you were a kid, a baby grand piano that you took around with you.
Yes.
So would you say? I mean, in the same way that, like, you know, cosmically,
yes.
First comes the groove. The groove came first for you, autobiographically, right? I mean, it was that. before right. you were interested in writing and you were interested in music.
Oh, yes, definitely. Mm-hmm. I was definitely started out as a musician, someone who loved music, someone who played music very not so great on the piano. So my mom loved jazz. They both loved soul music. My dad loved opera. And he's, 6'4", darker shade of soul brother, He would walk around the house lip syncing to Puccini and Wagner. And we would just sit there, you're like, what is this? Dad, and then by day he would put on a uniform and he'd go and be in the army. And then in the evening he'd come home and turn on the Puccini and walk around the house. That was Dad. And you'd be like, yeah, okay. The drama was right there in the living room.
Yeah.
Yeah.
During the first year of the pandemic, you wrote a play every day.
Yes.
And now, of course, this your plays for the Plague Year is going to be produced at the Public. I heard from you that you had your first rehearsal today.
We did.
And I should say that you are performing, acting, singing in this performance.
Yes, I am.
How? Can you please just, what was the...
I know. What's going on?
Huh?
Yes.
No. What was the impulse behind doing this everyday thing?
Right. Well, we were all, March 13th, what was it? March 13th, 2020?
2020, yeah.
Right? And we all were like minding our own business or at work or whatever. And they were like, we're shutting everything down. We're like, nah. And I said, I need to do something to prepare for the moment where when we all get back together. And I said, I don't know what that is, but I'm going to write a play. I could just sit at home at our dining room table where I write. And while remote schooling, third grader in the one bedroom apartment, which was at the dining room table also, husband there too, we were living there, like all of us, closed off from each other. I just started writing a play a day. And I showed it to the folks at the Public Theater where I am one of the writers in residence. And Oscar Eustace said, this is great. Let's produce it. I said, okay. And then he said, well, you have to be in it. And I said, oh, really? He said, yeah. Because I'd written one of the recurring characters in these little plays is called the writer. So I'd written myself into the plays without thinking that I was going to actually do it. I thought I was going to, pass it on to a wonderful actor.
Yeah. Maybe this is like a very rote question, but what's it like to memorize on the level of performance your own lines?
It's a little strange. Because I thought for a while, I told the actors, I'm not acting. Like I said to them, you're acting. I'm just being myself. And then I realized, well, I'm actually not even doing that. I'm pretending to be myself. So I'm not quite sure what it all means, but yeah. Mm-hmm.
I love the fact that every time I read your bio somewhere, you always say her teacher was James Baldwin. That sense of literary ancestry. Right. So... alive in you. I love that you always, that's always a part of the package that we get with you. As a 18-year-old, 19-year-old?
Yeah, 19, 20, is 80. Yeah, I'm old. So yeah, it was when I was 19, 20, yeah. He taught at Hampshire College. I went to Mount Holyoke College, and you could take a class in the five college consortium. And I was one of the lucky ones, the 15 in the class. Around a library table. He said it was the first creative writing class that he had taught, which is kind of amazing. And there we were, sitting there. And I was very dorky and shy and very animated. I was writing short stories then, very animated when I would read them aloud like this. And then the characters, I'd do all that. And he was just, like watching me like this. And he suggested that I write for the theater because I was so animated. I had no desire to write for the theater at all because theater people were all, la-di-darling, they would all talk like that. And here I am. So.
Do you notice any differences in how people start out in their sort of aspirations to be writers now that you're, you know, with students so often. One thing that I think about, you didn't go to grad school to write, for example. And now so many of the playwrights that we know, like institutions play a bigger part in creating artists these days, or nurturing or launching or whatever verb you want to use. Has that changed the structure of things or some of what we think of art? And
I think so. And again, the footnote to this is I teach at NYU, you know. So I have NYU, go Violets. And it's expensive. you know, right? Yeah, it's high. That bill is high. And I think that creates a lot of, in my students, I mean, not in y'all, but in my students, I think it creates a lot of unnecessary anxiety. When I graduate, I have to pay this bill. But also, the competitive nature of the institution creates a kind of anxiety that I think creates an artist, specifically a writer, who is, as they say on the wall of the new school as you pass by, desperate to make their mark on the world. I was never desperate to make my... I just wanted to do the best work I could. So I think there's an anxiety that's happening because of the way these institutions are training artists. And which is why I stayed at NYU, because I'm like, well, if the majority of the training is like this, then at least I can offer my, you know, outlook and my sort of say on, well, you know, throw my words into the pot, you know, with the others. Yeah.
In the Times the other day, you mentioned feeling a certain compulsion in our culture to perform a certain kind of, like, whether it's Black joy or some other feeling as a Black writer that you're expected to kind of broadcast. I just wonder if you could talk more about that. What does that compulsion feel like, and how have you dealt with it, circumvented it, ignored it, whatever?
We do expect certain things of certain people, and I feel like as a Black woman, person, writer, human, certain things are expected of me, and certain things are like looked at. Why are you doing that? I have to, you know, I follow the spirit. So the thing about Black joy, which I think is important, I think I love to see Black people joyful on stage, on screen, everywhere. And we need to be clear about, in my opinion, where the joy really is. The marketplace is telling us that Black joy is what sells. I'm very suspicious about what the marketplace wants me to create, because I know, in my experience, where real Black joy resides. And sometimes that's in the place where there might be some traumatic thing that also happened. But two things, and why I feel this, so there are two things that make me really believe this, that we ought to take another look at this sort of rejection of trauma-based stories. That's very fashionable now. No more trauma-based stories. I heard professors at certain universities have to agree that their acting students won't be in any demeaning roles, which includes any roles when they're slaves. I'm like, oh, gee, that's a lot of my plays. Okay, interesting. And if either, I'm just going to drop one more thing, WWJD, what would Jesus do? You know, and whether you believe in Jesus or not, it doesn't matter. That was a person who went into the stinky places. Now, if you want to follow someone great who did cool things, a lot of those, that kind of person did some cool shit because they weren't afraid to go into places where there was pain and suffering. So, again, I love a good Black joyous story, and I think Top Dog is one.
Yeah.
But I'm not afraid of the painful places too.
Yeah.
You know.
On the one hand, Top Dog is about the love, as you say, but there, you know, there is tragedy involved. Like, what's the use of tragedy as a?
That's such a great question. I mean, I'm smiling because I'm writing about that right now in an essay that I'm writing. Yeah, because we don't think tragedy has a use anymore. You know, no, it's only good stuff. It's only happy stories, happy endings. If you write anything that approaches, you know, something that might make somebody uncomfortable. And I don't mean the titillating uncomfortable, like, ooh, I'm not talking about that. That's some bullshit, basically. I mean, let's be real, okay? I'm talking about the stuff that makes you reevaluate the way you are, the way you treat your neighbor, oh my goodness, I have to rethink some things on a deep level. Not, it made me a little squirmy. No, I'm not talking about that. So I do think that there is a great use of tragedy that we've forgotten about. And in the old, and again, I didn't go to grad school, so I'm just reading plays and coming up with some ideas out of the side of my neck. But in the old school, you know, like Greek tragedy, like Oedipus. Oedipus, you know, you guys know Oedipus, right? So that play, or if you don't know, just imagine, you know, it's an old play. Everybody in the theater going to see Oedipus would have known the ending already. Amazing, right? So it wasn't like, spoiler alerts weren't a thing back then. Everybody knew, oh, Oedipus, hey, he's really related to that lady that he married. That's really his mother. So they're sitting back going, yeah, this is going to be really interesting. They come to the theater knowing the story. And yet, the story is so all-enveloping that it's so moving and it creates things like catharsis. It kind of shocks them. It wakes them up. It moves them to reconsider basic aspects of their life. That's cool shit. You know what I mean? Now, just eating like sugar, entertainment, while it's really nice, ain't going to do that. Entertainment is going to anesthetize you and make you buy shit that you don't need. So I'm encouraging us to, as human beings, we have the equipment to do incredible things. So what are we waiting for? You know, right? What are we waiting for?
Susan Laurie Parks. Her Pulitzer Prize-winning play, Top Dog Underdog, has just been revived on Broadway. And she spoke with Vincent Cunningham as part of the New Yorker Festival this month. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour with more to come.
I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Martin McDonagh was a playwright in his 20s when he burst onto the theater scene in London. At one point, he had four plays running simultaneously on stages across London. But McDonagh also aspired to work in movies, and he eventually made In Bruges, a real favorite of mine, and Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri. McDonagh's newest is called The Banshees of Inisherin. Although most of McDonagh's plays were set in Ireland, this is his first feature film about the country. It traces the story of a friendship breaking apart, and it's set in the beautiful remote hills of a fictional island west of Ireland. The movie stars Colin Farrell and Brendan Gleeson.
Now, I'm sitting here next to you, and if you're going back inside, I'm following you inside, and if you're going home, I'm following you there too.
Now, if I've done something to you, just tell me what I've done to you. And if I said something to you, maybe I said something when I was drunk and I've forgotten it, but I don't think I said something when I was drunk and I've forgotten it. But if I did, then tell me what it was, and I'll say sorry for that too, Colin. With all my heart, I'll say sorry. Just stop running away from me like some fool of a moody schoolchild.
But you didn't say anything to me. And you didn't do anything to me.
Well, that's what I was thinking, like.
I just don't like you no more.
You do like me.
I don't.
You liked me yesterday.
Oh, did I? Yeah.
I thought you did.
Staff writer Patrick Radden Keefe interviewed McDonough at the New Yorker Festival.
So congratulations on the film. It's kind of a breakup movie.
So that's all it is for me. I mean, that's definitely the starting point of it, to be as truthful to the sadness, I suppose, of a horrible breakup, where you can kind of understand both sides in it. I think that was the balance that I think you're naturally on Colin Farrell's side, definitely to begin with, and even in the script writing stage. But the thing to get right was to see as much of the story from Brendan Gleeson's point of view too.
Did you? And was that what it was from the original conception then?
Yeah, there was an earlier version of it just a few years before where it went to a plotty kind of stupid, shitty place. But I just wanted this to be sort of plotless in a way, just to have the unraveling of this breakup be what the whole story was about.
Did you write having worked with these two actors before in Bruges, a very, very different movie, and yet one in which their dynamic is everything in the way that it is here. Did you write this one with them in mind?
Oh, yeah, very much so. We've sort of been wanting to get together in the 14 years since we made that. It hasn't quite happened. Obviously, I worked with Colin again for Seven Psychopaths, but I'd stayed friends with both of them. We always see each other if we're in each other's countries, and they've remained great friends. So we always hoped that something like this would come about. I've been very lazy about it, and I'm
When you got around to it?
Yeah. The fear was, because, you know, we all loved In Bruges, and we love how much people love In Bruges, when you're getting the team back together, you don't want to fuck up that love. You know, you don't want to do something that's lesser. You know, you can do something. I hope we've done something that's stranger, but definitely something that isn't not as good.
Yeah, and there's also, I mean, there's an aspect. It seemed to me there's a kind of fable quality to the story, and I want to talk about Ireland. So, I mean, because you're a Londoner, but grew up with Irish parents and spent time in Ireland during the summers when you're growing up.
Yeah.
And your parents live there now, right?
Yeah.
Not far from where the film was made. And,
yeah.
And so much of your work has taken place in Ireland. And yet in the plays, I think there's sometimes also this like slightly fable kind of fairy tale quality. And I guess I just wondered, is the place where these stories take, is it a real place? Or is it a kind of Ireland of the mind? I wonder about your relationship to...
I think it's a sort of theatrical Irish place. You know, this island doesn't actually exist, but obviously the Civil War was a real thing and did... it is a very interesting part of the backdrop, so that takes away a little bit from the fable quality. But I think if you set anything 100 years ago and lean into mysticism and banshees and folklore and all that stuff, it's going to have... some semblance of that kind of thing.
And do you ever feel? I mean, I hope you'll take this question in the right way, because I'm a New Yorker who wrote a book about Ireland myself. But do you ever feel like there's a trespass or there's a license that you're taking? Is that something you're totally untroubled by, or is it something that you're kind of mindful of at all?
I mean, untroubled by it until the Irish reviews come in, then things get troubling. But no, I mean, it's like more than just summer holidays as a kid. It's like we grew up in London. All of the families around us were Irish. And so you'd hear Irish music blaring from each sides of our little area where we grew up. Mum and Dad were very proud to be Irish and, you know, encourage it in us almost too much. But we'd go for Christmases. Our grandparents were still alive in Sligo at that time. So as a child, it felt like we were half the year there and half the year in London. Obviously, my accent is very London, but London Irish is probably a good way to describe me. I don't have a British passport, which is probably a good move these days. I've only had an Irish one. But I've always sort of been anti-nationalist and anti-patriotic and all those things. So the whole Irish-English thing, I kind of find a bit boring these days.
Yeah. That makes one of us. I read somewhere that the that it was kind of a breakthrough for you as a writer when with plays initially that you thought about the way in which your father and I think your uncle maybe spoke, that there was a sort of idiom that you stumbled upon, and in the way that, you know, I mean, I would imagine in the way that for Mamet or Pinter, they kind of discovered a register and an idiom that unlocked something.
Exactly. In fact, Pinter and Mamet were sort of the two big influences, and sort of too much of an influence, in fact, because all of the stuff I was attempting to write then was sort of English or American based and very much sort of ripoffs of, you know, The Birthday Party or American Buffalo to a degree. And it was only once I knew I wanted to have dialogue be more theatrical than it is in real life. And I thought those were the best two people around who were doing that. But it was when I tried to do that in a West of Ireland context that things did open up and allowed the dialogue and the characters even to be a bit more poetic and heightened than the everyday London kind of stuff that I was trying to do.
I wanted to ask you, because you've had this fascinating career where you started with plays and then moved into film and have continued to do both. But I went back and I started reading these interviews that you did early in your career, 25 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
You suddenly burst onto the scene, this young guy in his 20s. You'd written 7 plays in less than a year and just came out of nowhere. And there were these amazing interviews where you would talk to people who were clearly filled with a kind of wonder and envy. And they would say, like, you know, you're the first person since Shakespeare to have 4 shows simultaneously in London. Like, how do you do it? And your reaction was always, theater's fine. What I really want to do is get into movies. And you could feel they were so kind of crestfallen. I feel terrible because I know Fintan O'Toole, but I have to quote you this. This is you and Fintan O'Toole in 1998 for Bomb magazine. You said, "I would be unhappy if I wrote 90 good plays and didn't make a good film. But if I made one good film, if I made one brilliant film, one really, really good film, I'd be happy. One would be enough." And then you say, like, clearly you're
what
kind
an
of,
arrogant little dick.
You're
I
sort of, no, what I love is that it's Fintan who's there and he's celebrating your you know, budding career as a playwright. Clearly there was something going on in his face because you then say, "You really love theater, maybe," to him. And Fintan says, "I do."
Oh, sweet Fintan.
So here's what I...
And his love of theater.
Here's exactly right. So here's what I wondered is... I wonder a couple of things. I mean, one is when you sit down to write something, how do you know if it's a movie or a play?
If it's got 4 characters and it's set inside, it's a play. And if it doesn't have any donkeys or dogs, cats, it could go
cats
either way.
Cats you can manage. Yeah. And you said to The Guardian recently that you may want to devote the remainder of your career chiefly to films.
Well, it's something, weirdly, I don't know if it's just because Brendan Gleeson's character is on my mind, but definitely during COVID, one does, you know, think of time passing and how much time you've got left. And I've sort of discovered as years gone by that it takes as much time or longer to do a play, to get it on, you know, off West End in London to West End to off Broadway to here. That'll be like 4 years or so. Whereas, you know, we made this last year and it's out now. So to take care of a play from start to finish does, you know, take a similar amount of time. I do feel like, you know, the plays that we got good like 25 years ago, you can't see them. They're all gone, you know, forever. And there's a sadness to that, I feel. And as the years go on, I always, as much as I used to slide plays off, I do love them if they're done my way. If they're done in a certain way, you know, Pinter's way or early Mamet's way or whatever. But, I'm not going to swear off plays because if I get a good play idea, I'll jump into it. But if I'm seriously thinking about, if you, you know, you've got 20 years, 30 years left, you know, a film every couple of years is going to last more than a play will.
How do you decide on the setting of your movies, and how do you do the research?
Well, for this one, certainly, my parents lived just across the bay from the Aran Islands, so and that whole area of the West, Connemara, up through Sligo and Mayo, is all the way down to Cork and Kerry. The whole West is, I sound like the Irish tourist board now too, but it is the most beautiful part of the country, I think. And I always wanted to set something there and capture the beauty of it. With three billboards, also it was to, you know, to try and capture almost an old American small town with like a street that's kind of both sides close together, and, you know, one horse sort of town. So location is always, and obviously Bruges was Bruges was a character. I do like the locations to be characters in the movies as much as possible.
When you watched the film for the first time, did you find it sadder or more hopeful than you originally anticipated?
I think I was always trying to make it as sad as possible. Once it's finished, I don't think I've got enough distance to know where it lies right now. Maybe I'll ask people afterwards. Who actually, show of hands, who is going to be sad or hopeful? Who think it's a sad film? Oh, shit.
Well, mission accomplished.
Any hope out there? Oh, wow. Okay, so that's, I guess it's a sad film. We're definitely not going to win the Oscar.
Thank you so much, Martin, for coming.
Thanks,
Thank you to all of you.
Thanks,
for coming
everyone.
To the New Yorker Festival. Good night.
The New Yorker's Patrick Radden Keefe, speaking with director and screenwriter Martin McDonagh. And we'll be bringing you more conversations from the New Yorker Festival this fall, including my conversation with Bono, the lead singer of U2. I'm David Remnick. Thanks for listening today. See you next time.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Merrill Garbus of Tune Yards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado and Louis Mitchell. This episode was produced by Emily Botine, Brita Green, Kalalia, David Krasnow, Louis Mitchell, and Gofenin Putubwele,
along with Jeffrey Masters, Wu Coley, Jenny Lawton, and Michael May. And we had assistance from Harrison Keithline and James Napoli.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.
This is Ira Flatow, host of Science Friday. For over 30 years, the Science Friday team has been reporting high-quality science and technology news, making science fun for curious people by covering everything from the outer reaches of space to the rapidly changing world of AI to the tiniest microbes in our bodies. Audiences trust our show because they know we're driven by a mission to inform and serve listeners first and foremost with important news they won't get anywhere else. And our sponsors benefit from that halo effect. For more information on becoming a sponsor, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.